Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Purpose Tune Podcast. The goal of my show is to create valuable content to broaden your knowledge, inspire you, and get you in the right mindset so that you can apply it in your own life to drive impact, generate meaning, and achieve your purpose. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Purpose Tune Podcast. My name is Kong Shang, and I am the host of the podcast, the Purpose Tune Podcast. The goal of my show is to create valuable content to broaden your knowledge, inspire you to act, and get you in the right mindset so you can apply it in your own life to drive impact, generate meaning, and achieve your purpose. Now, today's guest is Brent Cooper. Brent is the New York Times bestselling author of The Lean Entrepreneur and CEO of Moves the Needle. He helps entrepreneurs launch products for 25 years and is also considered to be a startup community organizer. Brent, let's check in. What's going on? Yeah.
Not much, man. How are you? Thanks for having me, Kong.
Yeah, of course. I'm very excited to have you on. Thank you for your time. I really want to invite more guests on my show who can speak to the entrepreneur mindset. Because as you know, with the great resignation and, you know, people leaving jobs, they're stepping into this space of unknown, which is entrepreneurship. And so let's just dive in. How did you get started in this work?
Yeah, I never considered myself an entrepreneur. As a matter of fact, I still don't even use the word. And so that's actually even a message for your audience. Like, don't worry about whether you consider yourself an entrepreneur, because it's really the mindset that matters rather than whether you go and actually start a big, you know, startup and try to scale it up and all the rest. So I sort of never considered myself an entrepreneur, but I always wanted to do things differently. And back when I was working at a variety of jobs, you know, I joke that I was tossed around like a hot potato between all of the managers because nobody wanted to manage me. And the reason was because I wanted to do things my own way. And so I guess that was entrepreneurial without me necessarily being an entrepreneur. And so then I started working in startups up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, we were just talking about. And that was really my first taste of, here's businesses that actually appreciate that kind of behavior, because that's what drives the company forward, is having a bunch of people that are willing to take things on their own and go make sure they get done, right? And so that's part of the entrepreneurial spirit. You know, eventually I just, after the dot-com crash, early 2000s, there were a bunch of different people talking about, well, you know, why do we build startups to make them look like big companies? That's a great way to weed out that entrepreneurial spirit. It crushes that spirit. And so I ended up writing the first book that talked about lean startup and customer development and product market fit and all of those things that are kind of buzzwords today. And really writing that new book, that book sort of launched this whole different career on how I could teach people how to apply it. And of course, back in the day, we thought that only applied to big tech. I want to be a Silicon Valley, you know, tech startup. And then we go like, well, wait a second, big companies could use this too. And then I was thinking like, actually small business owners could use it too. And wait a second, even startup ecosystems themselves can use it. And so finally it kind of gels that that spirit applies to anywhere where there's uncertainty. And so it doesn't matter if you're a social impact entrepreneur or want to be, you know, a high tech gazillionaire. It doesn't matter if you're a project manager or a product manager. It doesn't matter if you're just trying to do a side hustle. It's wherever there's uncertainty, I need to use this more learning approach, this the exploration behavior. And so the last couple of books have been about that. The Lean Entrepreneur was sort of a deep dive into how to do that. And then my more recent book, Disruption Proof, is really trying to get corporations to organize and manage and structure their work around this idea that you have to balance the execution work with exploration work. And we work actually with social impact people and nonprofits and various government even, because I think people are finally realizing that the changes in the world are sort of permanent changes, in the sense that it's just a more complex world. There's that much more uncertainty, and that's kind of the new norm. Everybody that's wishing to go back to the old norm is like going to be out of luck, because the new norm is endless disruptions, complexity, and a lot of uncertainty. So we have to learn to work differently.
So let's
I did a lot more than just how I got into it, but you get me going on this stuff.
No, I think it's great that you have such a passion on the subject and it shows. And I love that because we have to step into, what is it that wakes us up every morning, right? And so that's what this podcast is really about, is to really inspire people to step into the, you know, their truth and really, lead the life that they want. And I see that you're doing it, and, you know, you bring out such joy just because, you know, of, you know, your passion. And I love that. And we need more people like that in this world that can be alive. And by that, I mean, to be able to, you know, show up every day, excited about work and be happy doing the work that they do and loving it, right? Otherwise, what's the point of living? And so that's great. You mentioned earlier about the exploration. Can you define, I don't want to assume, but I think what you're saying is creativity, right? Or is that something else?
Creativity is part of it, right? So, I mean, I think that we all have creativity. Again, it sort of gets driven out of people, a lot of people, and other people get to thrive on it. And then, you know, society sort of perpetuates this myth that some people are born with it and others are out of luck. And of course, it's not that way. We're all born with creativity. We're all born not knowing, right? And so our first years of life are all about being in exploration mode. And sometimes it gets the little guys into trouble, but and little girls, but it's all learning mode. We don't know how to talk. We don't know how to walk, you know, and so it's all exploration. And so exploration really is, it's about learning mode. It's about being able to admit what we don't know and then going out and exploring the world in order to figure those things out. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about, for example, just even a business, if you're trying to figure out how to grow, then instead of just like doing the things the way they've always been done, which maybe doesn't work anymore, you have to say, well, I don't know. So what do I need to learn in order to figure out how my company needs to grow? Mm-hmm. Or maybe I want to, you know, launch this side hustle of some sorts. And you're like, well, I don't really know what to do. And so you have to go into learning mode. And so I sort of used learning mode and exploration mode interchangeably. But basically, you know, there's actually techniques around it. We can actually learn how to do exploration mode. And so, you know, design thinking and agile practices and some lean startup practices. And, you know, there's a various number of frameworks and all of these things out there that can help people go out and not only get, you know, sort of grok the principles, but also then practice it. And like everything else, you know, we're not like deer that, you know, they get up on their feet and suddenly they can walk and they can run. You know, we need to practice. And so practicing exploration mode is a thing. Mm. It's not that we have to be born into it. It's that we have to, you know, be willing to admit what we don't know and go and grok the principles and then practice it. And then we get better at it. And then we start figuring things out and we make it our own and the craft becomes an art and you're on your way.
So as an entrepreneur, as, you know, someone who's a leader in the business, you know, who have folks that report to you, how do you show up in a way that says, I don't know, but at the same time, I'm instilling confidence in my team to lead the business? Like, where's that?
Yeah. It's actually really hard. Like, I still struggle with that. And most of the struggle is, well, it's on two sides. On my side, it's, you know, maybe it did come naturally to me. And so I sort of assume that it's in everybody else too, right? And so leaders are often empowering people, but they do it by just being hands off, right? Like, I have empowered you, go and do it. And that sort of misses the boat, because a lot of people actually have to be taught. And again, it gets back to that idea of getting the principles and then practicing it. And you actually have to, a lot of people need to be taught how to be empowered. What is the behavior? And so as a leader, I actually have to instill that behavior. And number one is I have to walk the talk. So I have to demonstrate that. So everybody that knows me recognizes that I often say, I don't know. Because it's like, a matter of fact, early in the startup ecosystem days here in San Diego, people would come up to me afterwards and they go like, oh my gosh, that's so refreshing. I've never heard somebody at the front of the room say, I don't know. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just built into me as just like, I don't care what you think, you know, I'm going to just admit it. I don't know. And so, right. You know, just those words, I'm going to do a South by Southwest keynote this year. And I might like start that as my like opening line, because it's amazing the power it's actually a self-empowering statement if you think about it. So if you just go, I don't know, and you're willing to tell everybody in the world, I don't know. Well, most people in the world are going to go like, wow, I don't know either. Right? There's sort of that mirror gene going on, and it gives everybody in the audience permission right in that moment to go like, I don't know either. And of course, there's a handful of people, you know, the pundits, they're all on the news channels. They'll never admit they don't know. They know. And they're going to go and they're going to go and tell you that they know. But most of us are just going to go like, huh, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that opens up this whole universe of let's go figure it out. Right. And so that's really the key of the leadership, is that walking the talk. I don't know. How are we going to figure out? Okay, well, I want you guys to go and run these experiments, or I want you to go talk to stakeholders, or I want you to go try things. Don't wait for me to give you permission. You try it. I don't care if you come back to me and go, oh, my idea didn't work. That's fine. That it just gets us, I totally believe that gets us one step closer to what the actual thing is that will work, as long as we don't do that same thing over again. Right. And so I don't care if my people make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I just don't care. What I don't want is them to wait for me to correct it before they do it, or I have to approve it before they do it, because that just slows everything down to a grind, a halt. And I don't like it. I want you, no, you go try it. And I get people, I've been instilling this for ages, and I still get my team members come and go like, well, I'll send you this and then you can do this. And I'm all like, no. You go do it. And when it breaks or it doesn't work, then you come back and ask for feedback and how I can help you, and I can remove obstacles and we can figure it out together. But I want you to just go like, do your best. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work, I don't care. Then we can you can't overcome an obstacle until you run into it. You can't just sit there back and plan for all of the obstacles that you're going to run into and then figure out, okay, well, when I run into this one, this is what I'm going to do. And when I run, no, you go forward, you run into the obstacle, and then you rally your team around you. It's like, you know, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, right? You're going to have allies and obstacles throughout your journey. And so you got to go and run into those obstacles, and then you gather your allies and you get over the obstacle, and then off you go to the next one.
Yeah, seems like there's teamwork involved, collaboration, and of course, innovation, creativity, you know, is generated through, you know, people who collaborate together to figure out a solution. All of that is important.
The team part you mentioned is critical. My whole new book has a section on team as being the new unit of work. And so instead of thinking about, oh, I've got to hire an individual, or I've got to manage this individual, what we want to do is create teams that are overcoming obstacles together. They're like, you know, they're like special forces teams, right? And so I'm going to assemble the special forces team based upon the skill set we think is needed, is required to overcome a mission. And then as a leader, I'm saying, okay, let's establish your mission. Let's make sure you have the resources that you need to accomplish your mission. Here's how we're going to measure success. Here's how we're going to measure your progress towards success. There's no real hierarchy on this team. Whoever is the expert in a particular phase is the quote unquote leader for that phase. You guys establish the work that you're going to do, how you're going to get there, and then you come let me know how I can help you. And then you have to send me these periodic reports that say how you're doing. Boom, off they go. The team itself creates a social structure. And especially these times in COVID where people are still working remotely, we still need that team. And so the team is going to provide a social structure so people feel like they're, you know, with people. The team is going to prop up the one who's actually having a bad day or a bad week. And you know, so there's no like repercussions for that. It's just normal human behavior, normal human activity. It's going to reinforce values. So you're not going to have people that are going off and doing crazy things when you've got a team that's you know, adhering to the values. And so the team is the new unit of work. We have to think about how we're empowering teams and providing teams missions as opposed to sort of micromanaging individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing. Obviously, I've had my fair share of good and bad bosses. And of course, nobody likes to be micromanaged. And so describe your understanding of what an effective leader looks like.
Well, so, a lot of leaders have, empathy is sort of a buzzword now, which is, I think is great. It's like, even if you do empathy bad, it's sort of a step forward, I think. But so leaders often
get bad about empathy.
What's that?
Is there anything bad about empathy? I don't know.
Well, it can be done poorly is, I guess, what my point is. Like when corporations are talking about doing it in their TV commercials, I'm actually suspicious. Walking a mile in somebody's shoes, inside of a big corporation, that means people sitting around a conference table going, well, how would I act if I was wearing their shoes? Right. And so they're actually not, they're not really getting the point of empathy, but to get to your question, empathy is super important. Empathy for all stakeholders, for customers, clients, but also for your employees. And actually also for your bosses, which is sort of an interesting idea. Vulnerability. So we talked about admitting when you don't know. And so leaders that stand up and talk about their own failures or when they don't know is a vulnerable thing to do. Oftentimes still these days, leaders get to be leaders based upon being very good at what they do. They're experts and they're great at executing. So people that have succeeded with that mindset, for them to stand up and then say, man, I made a big mistake. That's hard, but you're giving permission to your team members to do that when you do that as a leader. So empathy, vulnerability, and then this idea of empowerment. And so again, empowerment is actually a big word and there's a lot to that. But I won't repeat that, but it's forming these teams and giving these teams missions and allowing them to organize the work themselves, as opposed to you sort of dictating what tasks are. And you don't want people telling you what tasks they did. You want them telling you the progress toward the desired outcome. And there's a huge distinction there. So a leader also then has to develop an equilibrium based upon, their different, their own personal mission, their group's mission. They have to develop an equilibrium between execution work and exploration work. So it's not just that people can go out and do all this great exploring and learning. They also have to get stuff done, right? Leaders and groups are measured, their success is measured by very well-defined outcomes. And so they actually have to figure out what that right balance is. And so I think that that's also a tough skill is, when do you be the sort of more command and control leader? And when are you the more empathetic, vulnerable leader? It's a mixture of skills that are required in order to accomplish the objective. And, I'm sort of no hippy-dippy capitalist, even though it might sound like it. Even if you're a social impact entrepreneur, what's driving your organization is accomplishing its mission. Not that everybody can just, sort of get along. Getting along is great, and I hope everybody gets along, but the mission is what creates the organization. And so you have to be still pursuing the mission. So all of this empathy and vulnerability and empowerment is in service to accomplishing the mission. And that mission can be purely business related, or it could be, social impact, or it could be, I guess a variety of other things.
Right. Wow. I mean, those are just important characteristics that you mentioned that, I see, would be ideal for, effective leader, someone that I would work with. I think going back to your point about vulnerability, I think some people feel it as a weakness when it's actually a strength, because it takes courage to actually show it, right? And your other point about, leaders that, they're at one point very good at what they did, but as they step up into a leadership role, They're not so hot when it comes to leading people, right? And so there's a difference between executing and on a task as an individual contributor, and then leading a team of people. And you have to have those soft skills, the people skills, in order to motivate people. What I've seen on my experience working as a consultant out in Silicon Valley, and even today, is that, especially in the tech space, is that and they have this challenge with how do we develop effective leaders, right? Leaders that lead teams. And we have, this discussion all the time. What are the skills or competencies that are needed in order to, for a leader to manage its people? Vulnerability, empathy, right? There's also this concept of emotional intelligence, which of course is a buzzword, but thinking even more broadly, in alignment with emotional intelligence, is this concept of decency quotient. And I often talk about this with leaders when they talk about emotional intelligence. A leader can have all the information that they want, because they're skilled at reading people, right? They have this, they're rated high in emotional intelligence. It's what they do with the information that counts. So that's where the decency quotient comes in. So for example, I had a horrible manager, right? She was really skilled at reading people. But when she was able to gather information, she didn't use it to develop me as an employee and others that she managed. She actually used it to hinder their performance, pull them back from their development. And so, and you see this play out in the workspace all the time. And so I think that we have to continue to, read books, do more research, talk to people to expand on these ideas, these characteristics of what, it needs to be an effective leader, so that we're up to date with all the constant changes that the business is going through. What are your thoughts?
My immediate reaction to that is that it sounds like we're sanitizing the word emotional, the emotional intelligence idea, in a way that I don't think is healthy. So to me, somebody that reads somebody else well, I would not call that like a real great EQ. I mean, a good EQ is somebody that actually knows how to develop empathy. And that isn't just reading somebody. Mm-hmm. That's actually taking the time to understand what drives and motivates and what that person aspires to. Mm-hmm. It's a way deeper emotional connection than like, oh, I read that person. That person's really insecure. Or that person is this or that. So I kind of don't like the idea that, and it sounds so Silicon Valley to me. I don't really like the idea that, somebody reads somebody well, and so therefore they have a high EQ. I think that that's like, that's ripe for really what you're talking about, is somebody to take advantage of that, as opposed to themselves. Like, so the words empathy and vulnerability go way deeper than this concept of that concept of EQ. Vulnerability would be is that I'm willing to put my own feelings on the line in order to understand you better. Mm-hmm. And it actually doesn't mean that I have to go off and develop a policy that makes you feel better. That's not the point. But I should actually be able to understand what the implications of my policy are on you and your life. And especially like you brought up earlier in the time of mass resignations, you better understand your people that well, because if you actually go and do something and everybody leaves, that's on you. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that we actually train these middle managers. I don't think we train these leaders very well in how to apply these concepts and how to make a more positive organization. Mm-hmm. And so part of the hiring and advancing process is broken, because we give these people teams to manage, and then we don't help them learn how to manage it. So why do we pretend that they even have the skills to do it? Is beyond me. But right. it's also part of that gap is that even if there is some amount of empowerment going on and sort of at the grassroots level, there's a bunch of agile teams or whatever, the the higher up you go, they're motivating their people the same way they've always been. And so these leaders, these middle managers are caught in this trap where they're supposed to be behaving differently, and yet their leaders are treating them the same old way. Mm-hmm. And so it gives them, they don't have enough flexibility to even do that team as a new unit of work thing that I'm talking about, right? So the team as the new unit of work, you know, includes like a layer, team of teams, and maybe multiple layer of team of teams, because what you want is that the missions roll up to the larger organization. So the missions, if you combine all the lower missions, then you have a product, right? And that product is serving its mission. And then there may be multiple products that roll up to that business unit's mission. And then multiple business units that roll up to that company's mission. But you want all of that stuff to be connected. And so it's very difficult in an organization that has a traditional hierarchy where everybody is organized by function. And yet what we want is this cascading mission idea. And so we lack the flexibility then to manage our people the way we need to in this mission-oriented structure. And we don't have the ability to allocate resources in order to accomplish those missions. And so then we start managing people based upon how many tasks they perform. And it all just kind of blows up again. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you're right. I think that the problem is really around, it would be interesting to flesh this out, even with the example that you gave. I mean, the person that was actually sort of understood you based upon their EQ, but then didn't do anything to actually help you, is probably locked within a structure that she just doesn't have the flexibility to do anything for you, right? So if she was managing to missions, then maybe she could actually do that easier. I don't know, I'm just sort of making that up. But I think that we put these managers in a box so that, and the box is even, you know, guarded by HR policies that are anachronistic. And so they actually have no way of doing things differently within their container. Mm-hmm. And part of what we teach is even going to HR teams and say, listen, you maybe be need to provide different and new services to your people in order to have a 21st century organization that's disruption proof, or this is all going to go, you know, to hell in a handbasket. And so then they can apply these same exploration principles to figure out what changes HR needs to make in order to make a new organization. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to get that to happen, obviously.
Yeah, right. Well, any sort of, request to change humans' behavior is obviously, you know, something that, as you know, very difficult to do. So this is great information. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on, you know, what it means to be an effective leader and how they show up in an organization and the tools or characteristics that they need to have. What inspires you to do this work?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's always interesting if you can look back on your life and find a thread that runs through it, you know. And when I came out of college, when I was in college, I majored in economics and in a minor in English. But the only reason why I chose economics was because I wanted to learn a little bit of everything. So electrical and computer engineering, calculus, you know, chemistry, sociology, psychology, history, you know, writing. And so I just took everything. And so then I left college and I went and got a job. And I remember I was just sitting on the front stoop of a house I lived in Clarendon, Virginia, I think, which is close to Washington, D.C. And I was all like, what, is this my life? 9 to 5 from here on out, this is it? And within a year, I had quit my job, sort of dropped out. And I wrote a novel, and it was really horrible, sophomore novel. But even then, I sort of felt, number one, I was very privileged. Like, this was all my own money. I did this myself, but being, you know, middle-class, upper-middle-class, white male in this world makes me a very privileged individual. And so even just my mindset and my intelligence and my education and all of these things that I got from my parents, these are not things that I earned, this was things that I was gifted. It just I felt empowered that I could walk away from my job at any time. And that sort of freedom is extraordinary. And so I remember telling my girlfriend at the time that what I wanted to do was to give that freedom to everybody. And it's a sort of this long circuitous path, but it's amazing because here I am, boy, a long time later, 40 years later, 30 years, I don't make me do the math. I'm still sort of doing that, right? I want everybody to be able to have their own, be in charge of their own economy, because that's freedom. And I think that a lot of these people that are, you know, sort of the mass resignations and people trying to go and figure out what they can do entrepreneurially is all of that. It's like the time is ripe for economic freedom, and you can do so much with digital, and everybody has creativity like we talked about at the very beginning. And so it's really just trying to figure out how to leverage that in order to create and be responsible for your own economy. And it's kind of funny to me because it's, you know, I think that, you know, we live in tough times. We've got, you know, the right that's going completely crazy and the left that wants to bring back all of the unions and all the rest, which is great. I'm all for worker rights, but we have to be careful that we're not actually taking power away from the human beings to control their own economy. That's freedom. And that's what the gig economy kids want, right? Not kids, sorry for it. But it's like, we want to have that power inside of ourselves because that is what freedom is. And really, I think that that's the human freedom that everybody aspires to. Mm-hmm. And so it's a long journey, but the more we get that, the more people will be able to balance, you know, all of these other cliches, balance life work, choose whether they're going to be, you know, going into the city to work or whether they're going to stay, you know, at a co-working spot, right? I mean, all of these things that we're wrestling with are improved by empowering the individual to be responsible for their own economy.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. What advice would you give for folks who are thinking about making that leap to entrepreneurship?
Well, I think that the first thing is that you don't necessarily have to make the leap. Like you can work, continue your job, and then you just need to be disciplined enough to do it on the side until you're actually successful enough that you can make the leap. This is especially important for people that are like in families. If you're young and you don't have a family yet, you know, all you have to do is sort of have that confidence that you're actually going to make it work. But we need money in society. We need money to live. So it makes it hard. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, there's, you know, I've got a new website. I'm about to launch a course on this stuff at startupbluebook.com. And it really is a way to go through the process of developing empathy for customers and running experiments and doing all of these things for you to try to figure out whether you've got something viable and then even work on the viability, right? And before you make that leap. But there's really nothing stopping anybody from figuring out what a side hustle is and then maybe hopefully turning that side hustle into the main source of income. I'm not sort of the rah-rah guy, you know, go and do it, just do it. There's a process to it and there's a way to test it. But I do think that, you know, the people that are the most successful at this stuff are the people that hustle, right? So the size of the change that you make in the world or in your own life is directly proportional to how relentless you are in pursuing it. And so if, you know, at 7 o'clock at night, after you've been working all day, if you choose to watch TV instead of work on your side hustle, that's fine. More power to you. But don't pretend that you actually are doing the side hustle or that that's actually something that you want to go do. You value the rest and the relaxation and the entertainment more, which again is totally fine. But those things are like, you have to get that straight in your own mind about what it is that you are really wanting. And if actually you find that you're doing stuff sort of counter to what you truly want, then, you know, then you need to socialize. You need to go find like-minded people. You need to go find your accountability partners that will, you know, help you drive and get yourself off the couch to go do that. And believe me, I have this problem. I get very comfortable and then it's hard for me to go and do the things that I really ought to be doing. And I kind of go in waves around that. And so being able to fill up those times where you're not motivated with things more positive than TV is good, right? Go and do something athletic, go and do something for somebody else, go visit your, you know, your grandmother, do something that's actually creating value for other people. And you'll find that those sort of rough parts are smoothed over a bit. It's getting out of your own mind and going and just helping somebody else actually will help you quite a bit in that endeavor.
Yeah, so there's several points that you made about just the process, right? It's an up and down process, you know, when it comes to entrepreneurship. I think a lot of people in this field tend to look at the destination where they're going and not really taking moments to appreciate the process, right? Like those, you know, when we stumble on a roadblock, like that's part of the process, and we have to acknowledge it and find some inspiration or beauty within it, right? Because it's these roadblocks are opportunities for us to learn more about who we are on a personal and professional level, as well as gives us the learning experience to apply for roadblocks in the future when we do stumble across similar ones. And so I think it's like, you know, I do enjoy my time watching entertainment because that's kind of like my me time. Like when I've had a long day at work and I don't feel like working on my podcast, like I need that. It's a way for me to just like decompress from a long day's work and just really just, you know, just not have to think about anything and just like tune out for a bit. And, totally. And that's kind of like a way to refresh my energy and focus so that when I am back on track, I am ready to go and I'm on execution mode and I'm strategic and all that stuff.
Yeah, right? I love that. So you're speaking to the Zen in me. I totally agree with that. I like to say don't just do what you're passionate about. Be passionate about what you do. I joked at a startup event that if I just did what I was passionate about, it would be, you know, playing basketball and eating bacon or something, right? And there's not much of a business model there. So it's the entrepreneurial process has a lot of downsides, and you have to roll with that. You have to be in that moment and you have to be willing to do it. And even if you can, be passionate about it, do it at your best ability. And that, so, mm-hmm. you know, if you're developing a high tech software, I sort of try to make this point that, you know, there's a bunch of really remedial tasks when you're actually developing software, and it's a drag and it's time consuming and it's boring, but you can't have your product if you don't do it. So you have to go with it. You have to go into it and you do it the best that you can. And that's sort of the Zen of doing any of these things. It's being in the moment and appreciating where you are and going into the downsides and going into the sadness, as well as going into the good sides and the successes. That's what makes us distinctly human, is that we can actually be aware of all of those things. And so we can appreciate both sides of the coin.
Mm-hmm. What does purpose mean to you?
What is purpose? Well, I mean, I think that it's very related to the mission. I think that the purpose, well, I don't know. To me, the purpose is the meaning of your life. Why are you here? And again, I'm no spring chicken. So it's gotten me, it has varied over the years. But it's, again, it's interesting to look back and sort of find a thread that runs through it. And so maybe you can even do that in your own sort of self-reflection is even as a younger person is like, well, what is the, if I think back to my childhood and what was inside of my mind when I was younger, and if I think through, you know, the struggles or the, you know, wins in high school and what I did in, you know, after school and all of these things, is there a thread that runs through it? And that thread very well might be related to your purpose. To me, a very sort of a healthy way in general of looking at it is that I think, you know, people's purpose should be related to creating value for other human beings. It allows you to define that in any way that you want, But I do think that if one only concentrates on things that are coming to me, what I feel benefits me, is actually a lonelier and colder path than if you turn it around and go, well, what can I do for those outside of me? Which actually probably it does bring back whatever thing that you were really looking for inside of you. So that's to me, I think that that's actually a natural way for humans to be. If depending upon the circumstances, obviously it's difficult for a lot of people, but for generally, I think that humans have always wanted to give to families and tribes and communities, that it's what actually brings a sense of calm and a sense of being, you know, sort of who we are naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree 100%. It taps into this sense of belonging and for us to really feel like we're seen and feel important. This has been such an incredible talk. I know we're about that time. I do want to be respectful of your time. So if people choose to connect with you, where can they find you?
Yeah, I encourage people to reach out. So Brant@BrantCooper.com, Brant Cooper on all the social media. Connect with me, send me an email. I've got, you know, multiple websites, but for individuals, typically BrantCooper.com or StartupBlueBook.com. But yeah, reach out. Happy to help out if I can.
Thanks, Brant. I appreciate it. Folks, if you enjoyed this podcast talk, I do encourage you to reach out to Brant and pick his brain on any of the topics that we talked about, and make sure that you click like and share with your friends and family. And thank you for listening.